as we governments are responsible for decisions that will impact future generations, we have the moral responsibility to echo the people's demands for climate justice and for the elimination of fossil fuels.
I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Freedom. My name is M1. I'm half of the legendary Tell It Like It Is, Everything Is Political rap duo Dead Prez. And this is WPFW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
A toda mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, October 3rd, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Venezuela's right-wing corporate media, their role in the 2002 coup against Hugo Chavez, and what we can learn from this moment in Latin American history as media consolidation in the U.S. grows and freedom of speech shrinks. And so joining us on the show again today is Maria Paez Victor, who's a Venezuelan-born PhD sociologist living in Canada. Welcome back to the show, Maria Paez Victor.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Also joining us today is Joe Emmersberger, who's a freelance writer and engineer, also based in Canada. Welcome back to the show, Joe Emmersberger.
Thank you for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. So in the U.S., one story that has made headlines and public outrage is the cancellation over comedian Stephen Colbert's show on CBS and Jimmy Kimmel's recent suspension from his show on ABC, respectively. Underneath the headlines are attempts from multinational media companies looking to buy these networks, and this sort of media consolidation is going hand in hand with censorship and restricting freedom of speech. What does this have to do with Venezuela? This is what we'll explore today and later on in the conversation, because there are certain aspects of Venezuela's media landscape that are similar to the U.S., but the similarities end when we examine how the government and the public responds to corporate control of the media. We could start this conversation in a million different directions when it comes to corporate media in Venezuela, but to give an example to the public of what Venezuela's corporate media looks like, can either of you tell us about who is the late Gustavo Cisneros and Venevisión? Because this individual and this company has an influence on American Spanish-speaking media that a lot of people may not be aware of.
Well, Gustavo Cisneros is a very sinister individual. This is one of Venezuela's most rich person, and he consolidated his empire through the TV. But he didn't stop there. He was extremely right-wing and wanted very much from the very first, detested Chavez and, of course, afterwards, Maduro. his TV channel became not a TV channel, but actually part of the opposition. It became an opposition party. I think it was Cisneros who, this is an anecdote, but when Chavez was first elected, he came out of nowhere and he won the elections, practically. This is how the elite saw it. And Cisneros, who had actually given some money to his campaign, because, of course, they like to be, you know, good with everyone, went to visit him at the palace and said to him, oh, we have here a list of the people you should have in your cabinet. And Chavez, he didn't know who he was dealing with. Chavez said, do you know who you're talking to? You know, I am the president of all Venezuelans, and you and your list can leave my office right now. And so that started the animosity immediately. They said, we're going to get rid of this clown. We're going to get rid of this pata en el suelo, as we say, a guy without shoes, you know, a campesino, a nobody. And it became a furious, relentless campaign, media campaign. He got all his buddies in the media also to back him to try and get rid of him. So this is Gustavo Cisneros, who then expanded his empire and went to the United States, and he bought heaven knows what over there, and he just became richer and richer. But within Venezuela, his empire went down because the Bolivarian Revolution, having had this coup in 2002, even they admitted it was the first coup done by the media. It was a media coup because the most important people there were the media. Imagine, they got together, top brass from the military and the Navy, and made a statement about how the government had fallen, all of this, before it had fallen. So they were already preparing the situation. And from then on, the government was, today the situation is different because the government realized these monopolies, these corporations are so powerful. Look, they actually did a coup against us. So with the Constitution in hand, they passed laws that regulated the media. Now, this sounds terrible here, but it isn't, because in Canada, we have the CRTC, the Conatel, followed the best practices there are in the West about controlling the media. For example, the language. The language was horrid. Language was terrible, the things that they said. So they said you cannot be using swear words and all this kind of thing. And the other thing is that they did regulations about what kind of programs they could show at certain times when the children were at home. So there are certain times of programs that can be shown, but later at night, you know, after 9 o'clock. So they did a certain types of programs, adult programs, juvenile programs, and programs where juveniles could watch if they were supervised. And things like the national anthem, people didn't even know the national anthem because they wouldn't show it. And now they have to show the national anthem when it begins and at the end, and at midnight when it all ends. But these are kind of, as I said, best practices. But the thing that the opposition loves to say is that there's censorship in Venezuela. Well, you just take a couple of taxi cab rides in Caracas, let's say, and listen to what the guys are listening to. They could be listening to a radio that is completely in opposition, saying all kinds of terrible things about the government, you know, criticizing them openly. There is, in fact, more diversity in Venezuela's media than, I won't speak for the United States, but I will tell you that there are more diversity than in Canada. You could have communists, you could have socialist, you could have far right. They could all say what they want in the radio or TV, so long as they're not trying to overthrow the government, so long as that they're not saying things that are creating havoc and panic in the population.
It's stunning that we're just talking about one media company, Venevisión, right now under Gustavo Cisneros. And that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to right-wing corporate media in Venezuela. In 2002, there just happened to have been an Irish film crew that was documenting the revolution when the coup took place.
Yes.
And the footage that they got with regards to corporate media and how they framed what took place is stunning. And we'll talk about that more in a second. But like I said before, there are some other bad actors that need to be pointed out here. So in 2004, the BBC quoted Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez when he referred to the four major media moguls at the time as the, quote, four horsemen of the apocalypse, end quote. So let's mention the other outlets here, like RCTV, Televen, and the newspapers El Nacional and El Universal. You sort of answered my question here to a certain degree as to how diverse media is in Venezuela, but unfortunately, so is the right-wing media landscape as well with these other outlets.
Yeah, Cisneros. One thing, in addition to all the comments Maria made, I'd like to note that Cisneros was actually a big donor to Hillary Clinton as well. Yeah, there's an article on Venezuela Analysis by Rachel Boothroyd from a few years back. You can look it up. If you search their website, you can find it. So it just shows, because this hypocrisy is that really the United States is a genocidal dictatorship. You have two factions of the same party heavily regulating speech, and yet they're leading the charge to vilify the rest of the world. Anywhere in the world where a government's in power that they don't like, they have the audacity to criticize them for regulating speech. There's no difference between the two parties. Have both. There's been a bipartisan effort to overthrow the Chavista government since 2002. There was a brief period when they thought, like Maria mentioned, when the Venezuelan elite and even the U.S., they thought maybe they could work with Chavez, they could buy him off, they could get him, bend him to their will, because after all, there's a huge precedent of politicians getting elected in Latin America. Oh, they seem very radical, very left, and then the next thing you know, they're just another right winger. So they probably hoped that would happen with Chavez. It didn't happen. And that's why it hasn't happened with Maduro either. And so there's been this relentless drive to overthrow him. During the 2002 coup, yeah, that Irish documentary is amazing because it shows how Venevisión, which was owned by Cisneros, they manipulated footage to make it to say to Venezuelans, look at these Chavistas firing on these unarmed protesters. But when you looked at the footage, you'd see that you don't actually see who the Chavistas are firing at. And what they were firing at was armed Caracas police who was in the hands of the opposition who were gunning people down. And they were armed people who were supportive of the coup. So they were defending themselves, basically. And that's why they didn't show you. They just told you, the Venevisión told you, they're firing at armed protesters. But when you looked at the footage, that you didn't actually see that. They were telling you something and trying to convince you that was happening. And in the chaos of the coup, people might believe it. So it was a total manipulation. And that's, again, Venevisión, which is, at that time, was by far the largest viewership of anyone in Venezuela. And so that was the 2002 coup, which was briefly successful. And it was applauded by the New York Times editorial board, was openly overjoyed that the coup took place. Same with the Washington Post, same with the Chicago Tribune. So it was a media coup in more sense than just the Venezuelan media, but in the Western media in general, they went all in supporting this coup and then were caught with their pants down because then the coup was reversed. And they were all looking very stupid and very sinister.
It was so outrageous when the final full-blown videotape came out that people realized, my goodness, this was a complete travesty. These people were almost killed by these snipers. This film that you mentioned is called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. This is very interesting because when the coup was occurring, the three television stations did not tell the people what was happening. They started showing cartoons, you know, Disney cartoons. They said, we're not going to televise what's happening in the streets. That's why that's the name of that. I urge your listeners, please look it up on the internet. It is available there. It is as if someone had had a film filming the taking of the Bastille, the French Revolution. It is absolutely wonderful, and it occurred because the two young men, no, a young man and a young woman who were filming it were not corporate media. They were just two students, basically. And so Chavez let them come in, and everybody let them come in, and they were walking around the palace. And while they were there, there was a coup. They stayed, and they filmed it. And it is one of the most wonderful pieces of documentary that I have ever seen.
Again, the name of the film is called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Anyone can find it on YouTube if they put Venezuela at the end of it. And like you just said, that it's a stunning film to watch how corporate media can operate in the service of a coup. And what's also stunning here, I do have a clip that I'll play in a second, but I have to say that it is stunning that obviously everyone here in this conversation and everyone in the WPFW audience agrees that Fox News here in the US is a nefarious propaganda news outlet. We can't even call it a news outlet, especially after the whole Dominion scandal. But even then, one can argue that Fox News was probably more transparent with the January 6th insurrection than Venevisión and RCTV because of the very manipulations that my guest Maria just described. And that just gives you a stunning example of how nefarious these organizations are. So on Friday, April 12th, 2002, the day after the coup, this same Irish film crew was documenting the coup as it happened. Along the way, they captured an extraordinary admission by coup plotters on the corporate media airwaves. So let's take a listen.
1 hour later, Venezuela awoke to a new regime and to an extraordinary TV moment in which all was revealed.
Buenos días. Tenemos nuevo presidente.
Debo decirlo. Gracias, Venevisión. Gracias, RCTV.
Yo voy a decir una cosa. Y nosotros tenemos que decir, tanto Venevisión como RCTV, gracias Televen, gracias CMT, gracias Globovisión,
gracias medios de comunicación.
¿Qué sucedió antes de eso?
El pronunciamiento del general González González a través de los medios de comunicación, y podemos decir lo que fue desde tu casa.
No, tú estabas en mi casa, perdona, porque me fuiste a llevar una foto de información que yo saqué aquí mismo. Pero, no estás claro, no metí en nada, soy periodista.
Sí, hicimos un video desde la casa de Napoleón. Cuando nosotros decidimos que Néstor, el general Néstor González González, saliera a la luz pública, era porque Chávez se iba a Costa Rica. Y nosotros teníamos que tener a Chávez en Venezuela. Y entonces ese pronunciamiento del general González González hace que Chávez no vaya a Costa Rica, se quede en Venezuela, y ahí es cuando nosotros activamos el plan definitivo.
So allow me to interpret a summary of what we just heard. We just heard coup plotters on corporate media airwaves in Venezuela in 2002, the day after the coup, basically admitting and bragging to their coup strategy. And the person laughing in there in that conversation is the quote unquote journalist for Venevisión or RCTV, laughing off what took place during the coup. The focus here is on corporate media for this conversation, but we have to remind the audience that people died before, during, and after the coup. And so the idea of a journalist laughing off and not recognizing or acquiescing to a coup d'etat in Venezuela is nothing short of shocking, no matter which language you hear about it. So I want to get both of your responses, but I'll start with Joe first. Upon hearing this clip, what are your thoughts, not just on the coup plotters admitting to their crime on the public airwaves, but also the supposed journalists laughing along with them and seemingly admitting to participating with them as well?
Well, yeah, you heard the names. They all said, thank you, Venevisión, thank you, Televen, thank you, Globovisión, thank you, RCTV. They're listing them one by one. They're backslapping. It's just a big joke to them, a big party to them. They're so euphoric that they pulled off this fascist coup. Yeah, and like you said, roughly 60 people were killed that we know of during this time. Pedro Carmona is the name of the dictator, was in charge for 2 days or 47 hours. So while he was in charge, there were like 60 people killed. And then during the coup itself, there were probably another 20 or so people killed. So yeah, this was a very bloody event. And yeah, they're applauding it, a total fascist coup, and they're applauding it and congratulating themselves over having pulled it off. And then they dare to later claim that they're being attacked. Really, my criticism of Maduro, I don't mean to say it's a criticism, because I understand why he can't go full 100% and really give these people what they deserve. But really, they haven't got what they deserve. I mean, so many of these people are still out and about at large, haven't been punished for what they've did. And this is the one coup attempt that was briefly successful. They've tried this several times since then for the past 20 years. So, you know, but Venezuela still gives these fascists, in my opinion, so much space. It's just, we should be out. And we know why he does it, because he has to be careful of the international reaction if he really clamped down on these people the way they deserve to be clamped down on. So, but it's really, it's disgusting. And I want to mention one guy because, you know, there's a lot of, I'm going to go harp on this point about the bipartisan effort, because Bush was in power when this coup happened, right? And so,
yes,
because Bush applauded, and a lot of Democrats were kind of critical. But remember, there was a guy who's a, this guy, Leopoldo Martinez. He was the finance minister for the two days or 24 hours, whatever, for Carmona. He's actually in, lives in the United States, and he ran for Congress as a Democrat. Okay. You can find him on Twitter if you go look for him. So I'm just telling you, it's a bipartisan dictatorship we have in the States. Their elections are meaningless. It doesn't matter who you elect. It's the same thing. So I just want to stress that again.
Maria, I want to get your response as well. There are other examples of corporate media collusion with the right wing, but this was the most stunning one that I could find.
But you know what they couldn't do? They couldn't overthrow the people of Venezuela. Because one of the most wonderful things happened during this coup, and that was the spontaneous coming together of the, I hate to use this word, ordinary people, because they aren't ordinary, the extraordinary people of Venezuela. Because the revolution was not going to be televised, a whole army, if you like, of motorcyclists, who are all young guys on motorcycles, immediately from the barrios got together and says, we've got to get the word out. And it was this movement of these young guys on motorcycles running around, passing the word, telling everyone what was happening, and urging people to come down to the palace to rescue Chavez. This was extraordinary. The one antenna, which was halfway up the Avian Mountain, which was the antenna that radio and the TV of the government used, had been broken. And these guys in motorcycles took people up there who weren't necessarily technicians, went up that mountain in their motorcycles and actually physically got that antenna back up again. There were so many stories of heroism that occurred during those times. My family, I have 3 members of my family were down there, and they were being shot at. And when I asked them, you know, weren't you afraid? Because these guys were shooting anybody, didn't care. It says, we just had to be there. And it was the people of Venezuela that came down. Caracas is surrounded by little hills where they live. And they came down. There was no place for cars to go because all the streets were full of people. And the people came down and demanded the return of Chavez. It was an extraordinary moment, because if this was a media coup, as we just heard on that snippet that you showed us, it was also a popular rescue, a popular destruction of a coup by people who were not being directed by anybody. This was not something that a political party was saying or whatever. It was a spontaneous. It was one of the most wonderful moments of true democracy in modern times. Now, I just want to say something. Venezuela, you know, they say terrible things about us, and the right love to say that there's censorship and there's no media. As I said, you just go to Venezuela, get into any taxi, and they'll be listening to a radio station that's saying terrible things. But Chavez, understanding after the coup, when he came back, that these media moguls were so important, said, oh, they think that there's no freedom here. I'm going to give them even more freedom. And what happened was that the government helped so that community radios could flourish. And this doesn't mean a radio that belongs to the government, okay? This means that you belong to a neighborhood, a poor neighborhood. You could ask, we would like to have a radio. And so the government would allow you to have the radio station thing that they needed. And then they would have a radio station for their area. So right now in Venezuela, there are almost 400 community radios. And these are radios that are not being told by the government what to say. They are addressing their own issues. They are putting up wonderful creative stuff, their own stories, the fiction, even, and not only documentary. They are having a way in which they can reflect on their own area, their own culture, their own ideas. Because before, these writers of the apocalypses would always put on TV, you know, stuff that came from other countries, you know, even the, we call them culebrones, which are the soap operas, you know, the girl with this lovely white girl, you know, and if someone was brown, he was either bad or a clown, huh? And terrible. This then reflected all the life of Venezuelans. So now what we have in Venezuela is a plethora of community radios. There is no communal council that doesn't have its own radio. And even some of them have their own TV, also studio for that area. So that's what Chavez did. He said, oh, yes, I'm going to multiply the media in Venezuela. And that's what did it. Our community radios are fantastic. If you go to Venezuela, make sure you listen to the community radios there. So I think there were more than 327, but there was a meeting just last year and they reached 400.
I just want to point out that since we're on the subject of public media in Venezuela, that during the first Trump administration, when they attempted a coup plot against Venezuela again, one of the first things that the right-wing opposition did was target public radio outlets, not only in the capital city, but throughout various other parts of Venezuela. Venezuela Analysis did report on attacks against public media by right-wing opposition during that time. So it's very important that you brought that up as well. I want to bring our attention here briefly to media moguls, whether or not they were present at the presidential palace during what is the infamous Carmona Decree in 2002, the day after the coup. The reason I ask is because we would not know about the Carmona Decree had there not been cameras present during that moment in time. And the Carmona Decree, for those who may not know, is essentially one of the coup plotters saying that all elected officials have been suspended, the Attorney General, the Supreme Court, the Ombudsman, all frozen out altogether, which is nothing short of fascism altogether. But going back to my original questions, were there media moguls present at that time during the Carmona Decree? Because otherwise, we would not have known about it without their cameras being present. Because certainly public media cameras weren't there at the time.
They were there and they signed their signature. And we have the videos of them there.
I just want to mention that Maria Corina Machado, she's one of the U.S. favorite fascist opposition people in Venezuela. She signed the Carmona Decree herself. She was one of the many signers. They read out on Chavista Media, they read out a lot of times the names of the, you know, I think that's become an annual thing where they read out the names or publish the names of the people who signed that decree. And she's one of them. And I remember that she tried to give an excuse later that she just thought it was a sign-in sheet. But it's still because you can see on video where they're telling people to literally come sign the decree. Like they're saying, they're not saying it's a sign-in sheet. They're explicitly saying, hey, come sign this decree. We put your name down. You're part of history. You know, please make sure that your name is here so you can be recorded as part of this great historical event. So, yeah. So they really were completely 100% convinced that this was going to stick. So that's why they exposed themselves so completely.
I want to talk about more about public media in Venezuela and also Maria Corina Machado and how, as you just mentioned, she's become a media darling in U.S. corporate media. But before that, we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Maria Paez Victor, who's a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada, and Joe Emmersberger, who's a freelance writer and engineer also based in Canada. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
No podrás quedarte en casa, carnal. No vas a poder enchupar, sintonizar ni echarte para atrás. No podrás estar enganchado por la escuelita y lanzarte por las chelas en los comerciales porque la revolución no se televisará. La revolución no será patrocinada por Xerox en cuatro partes sin comerciales.
La revolución nos demostrará fotos de Fox sonando una trompeta, lidiando una carga por parte de López Obrador. Ahumada, el niño verde para escuchar discos de Molotov confiscados de un santuario de Tepinto. La revolución no se televisará. La revolución nos demostrará casos de la vida real con Silvia Pinal y nos dará protagonizada por Andrea Legarreta, Kuro Becker, Adán Ramones y la Chilindrina. La revolución no te va a quitar el mal aliento, la revolución no te quitará el acné, la revolución no te hará lucir con 5 kilos menos porque la revolución no se televisará. No va a haber cortos de Bobby Larios y New York en su nuevo ficticio Infonavit. El noticiero no podrá predecir 48 horas antes quién de los candidatos ganará las próximas elecciones. La revolución no se televisará.
That was Molotov doing a Spanish version of Gil Scott Heron's The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. Reminding everyone, you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also find us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about Venezuela's corporate media with Maria Paez Victor, who's a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada, and Joe Emmersberger, who's a freelance writer and engineer based in Canada as well. So continuing on the issue of the media blackout, on April 18, 2002, the St. Petersburg Times wrote an amazing article on the role of corporate media during the coup in Venezuela. In the article, they quote Chavez, who said that, quote, during the coup, TV stations refused to broadcast interviews with members of his government to give their side of the story, end quote. Whether or not it's true, one thing is clear. There was a total media blackout on April 13th, just as Chavez's cabinet was retaking control of Miraflores. Even the same Irish film crew that we mentioned documenting the coup caught an image of CNN's Spanish broadcast interviewing coup leader Pedro Carmona saying everything was fine when it clearly wasn't. So I want to ask you, Joe, about the media blackout. Maria mentioned it a little bit, but before you do, I just want to point out something here that's not mentioned here in U.S. corporate media, that like the U.S., there is a vice presidency in Venezuela. You know, that would have been at the time Diosdado Cabello. And so if either Chavez or Maduro ever met the articles of impeachment, which they did not, then the next person in the line would have been Diosdado Cabello during that time. But it most certainly would not have been somebody like, say, for example, Juan Guaido, let alone Pedro Carmona. So with that said, I want to get your thoughts on the media blackout, even as the coup was unraveling at that time.
I remember that interview. It was comic book because Carmona was basically, the coup was very close to being overturned. If, you know, it was pretty much over for him. And yet he was saying, oh, don't, you know, we have total control over Venezuela. And CNN was just broadcasting this nonsense without any pushback at all. That's the point of being comical. But Chavez, that's what Chavez, when he was kidnapped, he insisted that he address the National Assembly. Because they say, okay, if you want me to resign, I'll resign, but you make me follow the Constitution, let me address the National Assembly. But it was so bogus in the sense that it was no, yeah. Remember what the Carmona decree did. It abolished the Supreme Court judges. It fired all the National Assembly. I mean, this is just so ludicrous. There's not even a pretense of following the law. They changed the name of the country. The Carmona decree. I mean, they assumed powers as if they were elected, and even an elected constituent assembly wouldn't act with these kind of powers. And they weren't elected by nobody. They were just the tip of a gun, just imposing themselves. And ultimately, it became a joke because then the guns didn't work. The guns turned against them, and they were gone. Obviously, they were just trampling all over a constitution in different ways. It's almost hard to know where to begin. But in the United States, in the corporate media, and everybody followed the line of the U.S. government. And so, again, we get to the fake democracy abroad. You could talk about, yeah, there was a blackout in Venezuela, but it was helped along by a similar blackout in U.S. media. Alan MacLeod wrote a book called Bad News in Venezuela. In the U.S. media especially, more than half of the articles, he's some over 200 articles that in various newspapers around the time of the coup, more than half of them didn't even admit that a coup had taken place. I mean, it's just the level of denialism and disregard for facts. It's just unbelievable. I mean, and all, something like only 10% could even talk about that, oh, maybe the U.S. was involved. Like 10%. And that's of hundreds of articles that he samples. It just gives you a sense of yeah, there's a blackout in Venezuela, of course, but there was also a similar blackout going on in the U.S. and even in Europe.
You're absolutely right, Joe. And if I could just let you know that when Carmona entered the Miraflores, he came in the car with the American ambassador. So the American ambassador was there doing this Carmona horrible thing. One of the first things that he did, he just stood up and he said, we suspend the Constitution. So there was no Constitution. There was no judicial framework of any sort once you suspend the Constitution. And once he said, we suspend the National Assembly, that means there's no Congress. So there's no Congress either. So it doesn't matter who was the president, was vice president, or anything. They were working in a judicial vacuum in which the only thing that was important, as Joe said, were the guns. But fortunately, the guns did not stay on their side, nor the people. They scurried off. There's also the pictures of them scurrying off, scared, like rats running out the back of the palace when they realized that the soldiers were not going to defend them from the people. So this was a great moment, and it had a profound effect on the Venezuelan people, because the Venezuelan people at that moment lost all confidence in the television moguls, in the TV. And that was the moment when they realized these guys are against us. And there's a wonderful section where this man, this very poor man on the street saying, they hate us. They hate us. You know, and he's talking about the media, what the media was doing. And so that moment, not only did it consolidate Chavez's power, but it took the blindness off the people when they realized that this TV people are scum. And so since then, although we still have, of course, a lot of private media is there and whatnot, one of the wonderful things that the Bolivarian Revolution has done, and this I applaud tremendously, is a great effort, not just for children, but also for adults, of media savvy, of media education, of critical thinking. You see this at every point. Every communal council, every program on Channel 8, you have to discern. And if you see something on the internet, these are the things you have to look out for. Because, you know, basically they're going to lie to you. You have to figure out and understand that everything that you read and everything that you hear is not actually true. And you have to use your own judgment. And these are very serious, almost professorial education, public education, so that the people are able to discern and use not only the media, but also social media.
And also in the documentary film, we saw that Channel 8 played a central role in helping Chavez's cabinet not only reestablish their presence in Miraflores, but also to notify and inform military people in other parts of the country of what took place and what needed to be done afterwards. So again, that lends itself to the importance of public media here to combat fascism, which is basically what we saw in 2002 and what we are still learning from in Latin American history almost 23 years later. Now I want to go back to what I mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is what does this moment in Latin American history have to do with media consolidation that we see here in the U.S. right now? Over the years, numerous corporate media outlets, government organizations, and human rights groups have criticized both the Chavez and Maduro governments of media censorship. And it seems very hypocritical now, considering everything we see with this current Trump administration and asking for comedians to be thrown off the air altogether. Looking at Donald Trump's demands to censor comedians over comments against him, MSNBC made an absurd comparison between what Trump is doing to that of Chavez, particularly with his challenge to RCTV. So Joe, I'll begin with you with this question here. With the 2002 coup as a frame of reference, how do you explain to people the difference between media censorship and challenging corporate power? Because it's something that I feel that people just simply don't get right here in the U.S. Venezuela, in my opinion, in the years since, have a better understanding of this, but we need to break this down.
Yeah, I don't believe in freedom of speech, to be quite frank. I used to. I don't anymore. First of all, there's no such thing. It never exists. It can never exist. Speech is always, in any society, very heavily regulated. Now, you can define in the Constitution, you can say people have the right to public debate or to speech, okay. But like any right, it's never absolute and it's always qualified. It's always regulated. I can have a right to health care. That doesn't mean I have the right to tell the government, hey, you have to pay for my hair transplant. Like, there's always limits, okay, in one way or another. There's always limits on speech. It's always regulated. I think the left gets that wrong. And because they get that wrong, the whole concept of freedom of speech ends up being weaponized against governments like Venezuela's, like Bolivia's under Morales, or like Korea's in Ecuador. Whenever governments try to confront media moguls, the cry goes out, you're infringing on freedom of speech. And what they're really doing is they're legitimizing corporate control, corporate regulation of speech, right? Elon Musk, guys like that who own Twitter, they might as well, I've often said, it would be more honest if they just nationalized Twitter. Instead, what they do is they get these billionaire surrogates to act as their speech regulators. And so speech is always regulated. And what we have to look at is how do we regulate it in a way that serves the people rather than elite interests. For a long time, I think I was confused about it. I think people are still confused about it. And I think that's something we have to push back on.
Twitter should be nationalized, and so should Facebook as well. Yeah. Maria, your response.
Well, I agree very much with Joe. What we have to distinguish is, what do we mean by human rights? Because human rights is an industry now. The human right industry actually came up after the breakup of the Soviet Union. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and all of these, you know, NGOs came up and obtained lots of money. Now, what were they doing? They were focusing on the human rights from the point of view of individualism. But they rejected the human rights of these other countries that had human rights in terms of community and society. That is what Venezuela, since Venezuela aspires to be a socialist organization or a socialist state, is very clear to distinguish. Yes, you have the right to religion and the right to free speech and assembly, but also you have a right to education and you have the right for food and you have the right to have a good environment and you have a right to health. These are the human rights that the state is obliged to make sure that are there for its people. Those are, if you like, the social human rights, which, of course, the human rights industry out there doesn't care about at all. You know, they look at it from an individualistic point of view. This is one of the problems that occurs with this business of freedom of speech. Do you have the right to walk into a cinema and yell fire? I don't think there's a country in the world that will say, oh, yes, you have the right to walk into a cinema and yell fire. Well, this is what the media was doing in Venezuela. They would say outrageous things like, you know, oh, a certain bridge fell down and, you know, 100 people are dead. And that wasn't true. And so the regulation was very important because it's in our constitution says you cannot openly say falsehood. Now, you know that the truth is a nebulous thing. You could say something thinking it was the truth and afterwards, you know, say, well, no, I'm sorry, we were wrong about this. But you cannot accept media that will openly back a foreign country, basically the United States, who is threatening to invade you, who is putting sanctions on you, where more than 100,000 Venezuelans have died because we could not buy the medicines. And you cannot have these media going on, rah, 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 bring in the Marines, which is what they were doing, which is what Maria Machado, all of the poster girl of the United States, was saying. Please bring the Marines in here and bomb. Oh, only bomb the Chavistas. Don't bomb the people who think like me. So These are the kind of things that the regulation of CONAPEL is doing. You don't have the right to create panic in a population based on things that you know are untruths. Now, as I said, you could say the truth, what is truth? But one of the things about truth is that you have to look at it from all points of view. And if you only have one, these people going around creating, you know, our vice president, no, our president of the National Assembly is a psychiatrist. He said, the people on the opposition have been made mad by all the crazy things that these fascist outlets have said to them, creating enormous amount of anxiety and needlessly. So, no, we don't have a complete free speech. And I don't think there would be any government in the world who would allow a media to openly go against the government and ask for its overthrow, not, oh, don't vote for them, which of course they can say that, and then also back people who are sending mercenaries and who are trying to overthrow the government violently.
We did a show here a couple months ago on Mexico's corporate media, and because of their economic and physical proximity to the U.S., they have now recently a major influence on Spanish-speaking corporate media in the United States, namely Televisa gaining control of Univision here in the U.S. And of course, Telemundo is owned by NBC. Now, for those who may not know, the late Gustavo Cisneros, who you mentioned earlier at the top of the program, once had a stake in Univision during the 1990s. But I can't necessarily say that Venezuela has the same influence on U.S. media as Mexico does right now, but it has had influence in a variety of ways. One, as Maria mentioned before, the aforementioned Maria Corina Machado, who has become a media darling. She's been on the New York Times, Forbes magazine, the BBC, you name it, she's been on it and sort of romanticized as this opposition leader. And so my question here to Joe, real briefly, is that how much is that an influence of Venezuelan corporate media or just the inherent right-wing bias of U.S. media to put this person on a pedestal, even though she was one of the signatories of the aforementioned Carmona decree?
I think she owes more to the foreign media, frankly. It's the decades now of vilification of the Venezuelan government, and combined with that, the whitewash of all these people who, she was given a very flattering write-up just the other day, just today, I think, in this article by Julie Turkowitz of the New York Times. They always give her a flattering write-up. Same with Enrique Capriles. He's still up here. The fact that these people are out of jail is just amazing. Like I said, if they got what they deserved, they wouldn't even be free, right? They're free in Venezuela walking around, and they wouldn't even be free if they got what they deserve for what they've done for decades now. And like Maria said, he's actually tried to get this genocidal dictatorship in the United States to actually overthrow them. And what happens to anybody's right to debate and speak when the U.S. imposes their fascists? I mean, that's, if you can't protect yourself, you're not protecting free speech either. If you don't have a right to protect yourself from being invaded, and then you don't have the right, you don't have freedom. I think actually Castro had it 100% right when he said, when people talk to him about free speech, he said, well, we debate, we do it. But if you think that we're going to allow the Washington to get control of our media, I said, no, that's not going to happen. If you think we're going to allow political parties beholden to Washington, then no, that's not going to happen. There are not going to be no political parties beholden to Washington and Cuba. And he was 100% correct. People don't understand that because their concept of freedom, like Maria said, is very individualistic, and it's blind to the elite interests who actually regulate speech all the time, constantly. That's why we're here on a small outlet like yours talking about these things. We're not broadcasting to millions of people on Fox News or CNN or ABC or anything.
Yeah, because there's the issue of concision on those outlets that say this in 500 words or less, or between commercial breaks.
Yes.
And that's the importance of public media outlets like WPFW, and the importance of saving lives as well, because I'm going to give the last question here to Maria, because the importance of public media to tell people what is going on in the world is not only important, but also dangerous as well. One of the most dangerous places for journalists in the last 15 years was not Venezuela, but actually Honduras. even now, the authoritarian president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, has put out, you know, arrest warrants for El Faro, a small independent media outlet that is not to the same degree as corporate media outlets in other parts of Latin America. The current head of one of the major newspapers in Guatemala was put in jail for talking about corruption in Guatemala. And so, again, I want to give you the last word that in this extraordinary moment, almost 23 years later, your analysis on the role of corporate media in this moment in Venezuelan history. And by the way, before you even answer that, we didn't even get to the issue of the racism and sexism on these corporate media outlets as well, which seems like an hour-long conversation in and of itself. But again, Maria, I want to get your final analysis in the 2 minutes that we have left.
Well, Chavez was right when he said, what we need are many, many radios and many TV stations. And he managed to help all kinds of communities to have media that reflects and is made by themselves and reflects their life experiences. This is really important. It's important for the communal councils. We have 5,000 communes and about, I don't know, more than 50,000 communal councils in the country. And most of them have a radio or a media or have access to that. And so I'm sorry to say this, but what we need in the United States and in Canada is less of monopoly. And we have these monopolies, yes, of these media that's for people that control the newspapers and control the TV. We need to have many TVs. We need to have much more radios like this one that you have. I want to say a message to the American people through here, those people who are listening to me. Please, Venezuelan people are not a threat and they are not your enemy. On the contrary, the Venezuelan people are facing the very same, I would say, challenges of this desperate and corrupt capitalism that we are in, that in fact we are in this boat together. What you have to do is please reject your country's attitude of violence toward Venezuela, because we are your brothers and sisters, and the things that happen to us may come back to bite you also. So this is a time for brotherhood and sisterhood. This is a time for the United States to pull back its fleet in the Caribbean. This is a time for the United States to sit down at the table and negotiate and talk with Latin America, talk with Venezuela, talk with Colombia, talk with Mexico, and not think that it can continue on the Monroe Doctrine trying to tell us what to do. We are sovereign. And we also love our country like you love yours. So there is a lot that we can share, but only if you put down your guns, both internally and externally. I read yet again another church that was hit in a most horrendous way by strange.
Yeah.
You've got to put down your guns. Your guns are killing you and your children, and they are now pointing towards Venezuela. And I beg of you to tell your representatives, stop with the guns and start talking like human beings should do. Thank you for this opportunity.
We've been speaking with Maria Paez Victor, who's a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada, and Joe Emmersberger, who's a freelance writer and engineer also based in Canada. So Maria, Joe, it's been enlightening. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you for writing.
Thank you, Oscar, so much.
And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
WPFW News in Washington. I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, November 21st. Here are some headlines. Hundreds more families are being displaced in Gaza as Israel's military moves its forces beyond the so-called yellow line in a new ground invasion that violates the ceasefire agreement. This comes as 4 children in northern Gaza were injured today in an Israeli drone attack, and at least 32 Palestinians were killed in a wave of attacks earlier this week. UNICEF reports that at least 67 children have been killed by Israeli army fire in Gaza since the ceasefire came into effect on October 10th. And, according to Al Jazeera, Israel has violated the U.S.-brokered ceasefire agreement at least 393 times. In more news, in a report released yesterday, Human Rights Watch concluded the Israeli government's forced displacement of 32,000 residents from 3 West Bank refugee camps in January and February of this year amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. The report describes the expulsions as ethnic cleansing and urged governments to impose targeted sanctions on Israeli officials and commanders, suspend arms sales and trade benefits, ban settlement goods, and enforce the International Criminal Court warrants. In other news, in yet another move showing Donald Trump's disconnect from reality, the president yesterday on social media accused several Democratic lawmakers of seditious behavior, calling for them to be arrested for behavior that he said could be punishable by death. The reality that Trump is ignoring or unaware of is that the U.S. Military Code of Justice requires troops to follow only legal orders, a requirement also referred to as duty to disobey. The lawmakers responded to the post in a joint statement saying, in part, every American must unite and condemn the president's calls for our murder and political violence. This is the time for moral clarity, close quote. Trump's posts come the same day a judge in Washington, D.C. ruled that the Pentagon's National Guard deployment in Washington was illegal. And as questions of legality increase regarding Donald Trump's orders to attack boats off the coast of Venezuela, he allegedly, with no evidence, claims are involved in drug trafficking. And in Brazil, most diplomats are still focused on a step-by-step strategy to fight climate change. Noah Portner has this report on one of the major challenges these diplomats are facing.
As COP30 reaches its 2-week mark, a climate change roadmap is still on the table as diplomats struggle to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. One major challenge is emissions surrounding the defense sector, which is often unreported or actively obscured by governments. Research from 2022 suggests that militaries are responsible for over 5% of the world's pollution. This means that if you combined every military into a single nation, they would be the world's 5th largest emitter. Much of these military emissions comes from production, supply chain, and fuel costs for ships and aircraft. Additionally, war zones cause a huge amount of pollution, with rebuilding devastated regions like Gaza costing even more emissions. Even the EU, which is leading the charge for a climate change roadmap, has most of its military-related emissions unreported. Some think it impossible to reduce or eliminate emissions for war, but the militaries of Austria and Slovenia are planning to do just that, to make their militaries completely net zero within a few decades. From WPFW, I'm Noah Portner.